ship two of his up north. They don't mind him up north. Yonder's one of them." A small boy clutching a Negro woman's hand walked toward us. He looked all Negro to me. He was rich chocolate, with flaring nostrils and beautiful teeth. Sometimes he would skip happily, and the Negro woman tugged his hand to make him stop. Jim waited until they passed us. "That's one of the little ones," he said. "How can you tell?" asked Dill. "He looked black to me." "You can't sometimes, not unless you know who they are. But he's half Raymond, all right." "But how can you tell?" I asked. "I told you, Scout. You just have to know who they are." "Well, how do you know we ain't Negroes?" "Uncle Jack Finch says we really don't know. He says as far as he can trace back the Finches, we ain't. But for all he knows, we might have come straight out of Ethiopia during the Old Testament." "Well, if we came out during the Old Testament, it's too long ago to matter." "That's what I thought," said Jem. "But around here, once you have a drop of Negro blood, that makes you all black. Hey, look!" Some invisible signal had made the lunchers on the square rise and scatter bits of newspaper, cellophane, and wrapping paper. Children came to mothers. Babies were cradled on hips as men in sweat-stained hats collected their families and herded them through the courthouse doors. In the far corner of the square, the Negroes and Mr. Dolphus Raymond stood up and dusted their breeches. There were few women and children among them, which seemed to dispel the holiday mood. They waited patiently at the doors behind the white families. "Let's go in," said Dill. "No, we better wait till they get in. Atticus might not like it if he sees us," said Jem. The Macomb County courthouse was faintly reminiscent of Arlington in one respect. The concrete pillars supporting its south roof were too heavy for their light burden. The pillars were all that remained standing when the original courthouse burned in 1856. Another courthouse was built around them. It is better to say built in spite of them. But for the south porch, the Macomb County courthouse was early Victorian, presenting an inoffensive vista when seen from the north. From the other side, however, Greek Revival columns clashed with a big 19th-century clock tower, housing a rusty, unreliable instrument, a view indicating a people determined to preserve every physical scrap of the past. To reach the courtroom, on the second floor, one passed sundry sunless county cubbyholes: the tax assessor, the tax collector, the county clerk, the county solicitor, the circuit clerk, the judge of probate, lived in cool, dim hutches that smelled of decaying record books mingled with old, damp cement and stale urine. It was necessary to turn on the lights in the daytime. There was always a film of dust on the rough floorboards. The inhabitants of these offices were creatures of their environment. Little gray-faced men, they seemed, untouched by wind or sun. We knew there was a crowd, but we had not bargained for the multitudes in the first-floor hallway. I got separated from Jem and Dill, but made my way toward the wall by the stairwell, knowing Jem would come for me eventually. I found myself in the middle of the Idlers' Club, and made myself as unobtrusive as possible. This was a group of white-shirted, khaki-trousered, suspended old men who had spent their lives doing nothing and passed their twilight days doing same on pine benches under the live oaks on the square. Attentive critics of courthouse business, Atticus said they knew as much law as the Chief Justice from long years of observation. Normally they were the court's only spectators, and today they seemed resentful of the interruption of their comfortable routine. When they spoke, their voices sounded casually important. The conversation was about my father.
"Thinks he knows what he's doing," one said.
"Oh, now, I wouldn't say that," said another.
Atticus Finch is a deep reader. A mighty deep reader.
He reads all right. That's all he does. The club snickered.
Let me tell you something now, Billy, a third said. You know the court appointed him to defend this nigger.
Yeah, but Atticus aims to defend him.
That's what I don't like about it.
This was news. News that put a different light on things.
Atticus had to, whether he wanted to or not.
I thought it odd that he hadn't said anything to us about it. We could have used it many times in defending him and ourselves.
He had to. That's why he was doing it.
Equaled fewer fights and less fussing.
But did that explain the town's attitude?
The court appointed Atticus to defend him. Atticus aimed to defend him. That's what they didn't like about it. It was confusing. The Negroes, having waited for the white people to go upstairs, began to come in.
Whoa now, just a minute,
said a club member, holding up his walking stick.
Just don't start up them there stairs yet a while.
The club began its stiff-jointed climb and ran into Dill and Jem on their way down looking for me. They squeezed past and Jem called,
Scout, come on! There ain't a seat left! We'll have to stand up!
Look a there now, he said irritably, as the black people surged upstairs. The old men ahead of them would take most of the standing room. We were out of luck, and it was my fault, Jem informed me. We stood miserably by the wall.
Can't you all get in?
Reverend Sykes was looking down at us, black hat in hand. Hey, Reverend, said Jem.
Naw, Scout here messed us up.
Well, let's see what we can do.
Reverend Sykes edged his way upstairs. In a few moments he was back.
There's not a seat downstairs. Do you all reckon it'd be all right if you all came to the balcony with me?
Gosh, yes, said Jem.
Happily, we sped ahead of Reverend Sykes to the courtroom floor. There we went up a covered staircase and waited at the door. Reverend Sykes came puffing behind us and steered us gently through the black people in the balcony. Four Negroes rose and gave us their front row seats. The colored balcony ran along three walls of the courtroom like a second-story veranda, and from it we could see everything. The jury sat to the left, under long windows. Sunburned, lanky, they seemed to be all farmers, but this was natural. Town folk rarely sat on juries. They were either struck or excused. One or two of the jury looked vaguely like dressed-up Cunninghams. At this stage, they sat straight and alert. The circuit solicitor and another man, Atticus and Tom Robinson, sat at tables with their backs to us. There was a brown book and some yellow tablets on the solicitor's table. Atticus's was bare. Just inside the railing that divided the spectators from the court, the witnesses sat on cowhide-bottom chairs. Their backs were to us. Judge Taylor was on the bench, looking like a sleepy old shark, his pilot fish riding rapidly below in front of him. Judge Taylor looked like most judges I had ever seen. Amiable, white-haired, slightly ruddy-faced, he was a man who ran his court with an alarming informality. He sometimes propped his feet up. He often cleaned his fingernails with his pocket knife. In long equity hearings, especially after dinner, he gave the impression of dozing, an impression dispelled forever when a lawyer once deliberately pushed a pile of books to the floor in a desperate effort to wake him up. Without opening his eyes, Judge Taylor murmured, "Mr. Whitley, do that again, and it'll cost you $100. He was a man learned in the law, and although he seemed to take his job casually, in reality he kept a firm grip on any proceedings that came before him. Only once was Judge Taylor ever seen at a dead standstill in open court.
and the Cunninghams stopped him. Old Sarum, their stamping grounds, was populated by two families, separate and apart in the beginning, but unfortunately bearing the same name. The Cunninghams married the Conninghams until the spelling of the names was academic. Academic until a Cunningham disputed a Conningham over land titles and took to the law. During a controversy of this character, Jeems Cunningham testified that his mother spelled it Cunningham on deeds and things, but she was really a Conningham. She was an uncertain speller, a seldom reader, and was given to looking far away sometimes when she sat on the front gallery in the evening. After 9 hours of listening to the eccentricities of Old Sarum's inhabitants, Judge Taylor threw the case out of court. When asked upon what grounds, Judge Taylor said, "Champertus connivance," and declared he hoped to God the litigants were satisfied by each having had their public say. They were. That was all they had wanted in the first place. Judge Taylor had one interesting habit. He permitted smoking in his courtroom, but did not himself indulge. Sometimes, if one was lucky, one had the privilege of watching him put a long, dry cigar into his mouth and munch it slowly up. Bit by bit, the dead cigar would disappear, to reappear some hours later as a flat, slick mess, its essence extracted and mingling with Judge Taylor's digestive juices. I once asked Atticus how Mrs. Taylor stood to kiss him, but Atticus said they didn't kiss much. The witness stand was to the right of Judge Taylor, and when we got to our seats, Mr. Heck Tate was already on it. Chapter 17. "Jim," I said, "are those the Yules sitting down yonder?" "Hush," said Jim. "Mr. Heck Tate's testifying." Mr. Tate had dressed for the occasion. He wore an ordinary business suit, which made him look somehow like every other man. Gone were his high boots, lumber jacket, and bullet-studded belt. From that moment he ceased to terrify me. He was sitting forward in the witness chair, his hands clasped between his knees, listening attentively to the circuit solicitor. The solicitor, a Mr. Gilmer, was not well known to us. He was from Abbotsville. We saw him only when court convened, and that rarely, for court was of no special interest to Jem and me. A balding, smooth-faced man, he could have been anywhere between 40 and 60. Although his back was to us, we knew he had a slight cast in one of his eyes, which he used to his advantage. He seemed to be looking at a person when he was actually doing nothing of the kind. Thus he was hell on juries and witnesses. The jury, thinking themselves under close scrutiny, paid attention. So did the witnesses, thinking likewise. "In your own words, Mr. Tate," Mr. Gilmer was saying. "Well," said Mr. Tate, touching his glasses and speaking to his knees, "I was called..." "Could you say it to the jury, Mr. Tate?" "Thank you. Who called you?" Mr. Tate said, "I was fetched by Mr. Bob Ewell yonder, one night..." "What night, sir?" Mr. Tate said, "It was the night of November 21st. I was just leaving my office to go home when Mr. Ewell came in. Very excited he was, and said, 'Get out to his house quick. Some niggard raped his girl.'" "Did you go?"
"Certainly.
Got in the car and went out as fast as I could."
"And what did you find?"
"Found her lying on the floor in the middle of the front room, one on the right as you go in. She was pretty well beat up, but I heaved her to her feet, and she washed her face in a bucket in the corner, and said she was all right. I asked her who hurt her, and she said it was Tom Robinson."
Judge Taylor,
who had been concentrating on his fingernails, looked up as if he were expecting an objection. But Atticus was quiet.
Asked her if he beat her like that. She said yes, he had. Asked her if he took advantage of her. And she said yes, he did. So I went down to Robinson's house and brought him back. She identified him as the one, so I took him in. That's all there was to it.
Thank you, said Mr. Gilmer. Judge Taylor said, Any questions, Atticus?
Yes, said my father.
He was sitting behind his table. His chair was skewed to one side, his legs were crossed, and one arm was resting on the back of his chair.
Did you call a doctor, Sheriff?
Did anybody call a doctor? Asked Atticus.
No, sir, said Mr. Tate.
Didn't call a doctor?
No, sir, repeated Mr. Tate.
Why not?
There was an edge to Atticus's voice.
Well, I can tell you why I didn't. It wasn't necessary, Mr. Finch. She was mighty banged up. Something sure happened. It was obvious.
But you didn't call a doctor? While you were there, did anyone send for one? Fetch one? Carry her to one?
No, sir.
Judge Taylor broke in. He's answered the question 3 times, Atticus. He didn't call a doctor.
Atticus said, I just wanted to make sure, Judge.
And the judge smiled. Jim's hand, which was resting on the balcony rail, tightened around it. He drew in his breath suddenly. Glancing below, I saw no corresponding reaction and wondered if Jim was trying to be dramatic. Dill was watching peacefully, and so was Reverend Sykes beside him.
What is it?
I whispered, and got a terse shh.
Sheriff, Atticus was saying, you say she was mighty banged up.
In what way?
Well, just describe her injuries, Heck.
Well, she was beaten around the head. There was already bruises coming on her arms, and it happened about 30 minutes before.
How do you know?
Mr. Tate grinned.
Sorry, that's what they said. Anyway, she was pretty bruised up when I got there, and she had a black eye coming.
Which eye?
Mr. Tate blinked and ran his hands through his hair.
Let's see, he said softly.
Then he looked at Atticus as if he considered the question childish.
Can't you remember? Atticus asked.
Mr. Tate pointed to an invisible person 5 inches in front of him and said,
Her left.
Wait a minute, Sheriff, said Atticus.
Was it her left facing you, or her left looking the same way you were?
Mr. Tate said,
Oh, yes, that'd make it her right. It was her right eye, Mr. Finch.
I remember now, she was bunged up on that side of her face.
Mr. Tate blinked again, as if something had suddenly been made plain to him. Then he turned his head and looked around at Tom Robinson. As if by instinct, Tom Robinson raised his head. Something had been made plain to Atticus also, and it brought him to his feet.
Sheriff, please repeat what you said.
It was her right eye, I said.
No.
Atticus walked to the court reporter's desk and bent down to the furiously scribbling hand. It stopped, flipped back the shorthand pad, and the court reporter said, Mr. Finch, I remember now she was bunged up on that side of the face.
Atticus looked up at Mr. Tate.
Which side again, Heck?
The right side, Mr. Finch.
But she had more bruises. You want to hear about them?
Atticus seemed to be bordering on another question, but he thought better of it and said,
Yes,
What were her other injuries?
As Mr. Tate answered, Atticus turned and looked at Tom Robinson, as if to say this was something they hadn't bargained for.
Her arms were bruised, and she showed me her neck. There were definite finger marks on her gullet.
All around her throat? At the back of her neck?
I'd say they were all around, Mr. Finch.
You would?
Yes, sir. She had a small throat. Anybody could have reached around it with just...
Answer the question, yes or no, please, Sheriff, said Atticus dryly,
and Mr. Tate fell silent. Atticus sat down and nodded to the circuit solicitor, who shook his head at the judge, who nodded to Mr. Tate, who rose stiffly and stepped down from the witness stand. Below us, heads turned, feet scraped the floor, babies were shifted to shoulders, and a few children scampered out of the courtroom. The Negroes behind us whispered softly among themselves. Dill was asking Reverend Sykes what it was all about, but Reverend Sykes said he didn't know. So far, things were utterly dull. Nobody had thundered. There were no arguments between opposing counsel. There was no drama. A grave disappointment to all present, it seemed. Atticus was proceeding amiably, as if he were involved in a title dispute. With his infinite capacity for calming turbulent seas, he could make a rape case as dry as a sermon. Gone was the terror in my mind of stale whiskey and barnyard smells, of sleepy-eyed, sullen men, of a husky voice calling in the night, "Mr. Finch, they gone?" Our nightmare had gone with daylight. Everything would come out all right. All the spectators were as relaxed as Judge Taylor, except Jem. His mouth was twisted into a purposeful half-grin, and his eyes happy about, and he said something about corroborating evidence, which made me sure he was showing off.
"Robert E. Lee Ewell!"
In answer to the clerk's booming voice, a little bantam cock of a man rose and strutted to the stand, the back of his neck reddening at the sound of his name. When he turned around to take the oath, we saw that his face was as red as his neck. We also saw no resemblance to his namesake. A shock of wispy, new-washed hair stood up from his forehead. His nose was thin, pointed, and shiny. He had no chin to speak of. It seemed to be part of his crepey neck.
"So help me God," he crowed.
Every town the size of Macomb had families like the Yules. No economic fluctuations changed their status. People like the Yules lived as guests of the county in prosperity as well as in the depths of a depression. No truant officers could keep their numerous offspring in school. No public health officer could free them from congenital defects, various worms, and the diseases indigenous to filthy surroundings. Macomb's Yules lived behind the town garbage dump in what was once a Negro cabin. The cabin's plank walls were supplemented with sheets of corrugated iron, its roof shingled with tin cans hammered flat, so only its general shape suggested its original design. Square, with four tiny rooms opening onto a shotgun hall, the cabin rested uneasily upon four irregular lumps of limestone. Its windows were merely open spaces in the walls, which in the summertime were covered with greasy strips of cheesecloth to keep out the varmints that feasted on Macomb's refuse. The varmints had a lean time of it, for the Yules gave the dump a thorough gleaning every day, and the fruits of their industry, those that were not eaten, made the plot of ground around the cabin look like the playhouse of an insane child. What passed for a fence was bits of tree limbs, broomsticks, and tool shafts, all tipped with rusty hammerheads, snaggle-toothed rakeheads, shovels,
axes and grubbing hose, held on with pieces of barbed wire. Enclosed by this barricade was a dirty yard containing the remains of a Model T Ford on blocks, a discarded dentist's chair, an ancient icebox, plus lesser items, old shoes, worn-out table radios, picture frames, and fruit jars, under which scrawny orange chickens pecked hopefully. One corner of the yard, though, bewildered Makem. Against the fence, in a line, were six chipped enamel slop jars holding brilliant red geraniums, cared for as tenderly as if they belonged to Miss Morty Atkinson, had Miss Morty deigned to permit a geranium on her premises. People said they were Mayella Yules. Nobody was quite sure how many children were on the place. Some people said six, others said nine. There were always several dirty-faced ones at the windows when anyone passed by. Nobody had occasion to pass by, except at Christmas, when the churches delivered baskets, and when the mayor of Makem asked us to please help the garbage collector by dumping our own trees and trash. Atticus took us with him last Christmas, when he complied with the mayor's request. A dirt road ran from the highway past the dump, down to a small Negro settlement some 500 yards beyond the Yules. It was necessary either to back out to the highway or go the full length of the road and turn around. Most people turned around in the Negroes' front yards. In the frosty December dusk, their cabins looked neat and snug, with pale blue smoke rising from the chimneys and doorways glowing amber from the fires inside. There were delicious smells about chicken, bacon frying crisp as the twilight air. Jem and I detected squirrel cooking, but it took an old countryman like Atticus to identify possum and rabbit, aromas that vanished when we rode back past the Yule residence. All the little man on the witness stand had that made him any better than his nearest neighbors was that if scrubbed with lye soap in very hot water, his skin was white. "Mr. Robert Yule?" asked Mr. Gilmer.
"That's my name, Cap'n," said the witness.
Mr. Gilmer's back stiffened a little, and I felt sorry for him. "Perhaps I'd better explain something now. I've heard that lawyers' children, on seeing their parents in court in the heat of argument, get the wrong idea. They think opposing counsel to be the personal enemies of their parents. They suffer agonies, and are surprised to see them often go out arm in arm with their tormentors during the first recess." This was not true of Jem and me. We acquired no traumas from watching our father win or lose. I'm sorry that I can't provide any drama in this respect. If I did, it would not be true. We could tell, however, when debate became more acrimonious than professional. But this was from watching lawyers other than our father. I never heard Atticus raise his voice in my life, except to a deaf witness. Mr. Gilmer was doing his job as Atticus was doing his. Besides, Mr. Yule was Mr. Gilmer's witness, and he had no business being rude to him of all people.
"Are you the father of Mayella Yule?" was the next question. "Well, if I ain't, I can't do nothing about it now. Her ma's dead," was the answer.
Judge Taylor stirred. He turned slowly in his swivel chair and looked benignly at the witness. "Are you the father of Mayella Yule?" he asked, in a way that made the laughter below us stop suddenly.
"Yes, sir,"
Mr. Yule said meekly. Judge Taylor went on in tones of goodwill. "This the first time you've ever been in court? I don't recall ever seeing you here." At the witness's affirmative nod, he continued, "Well, let's get something straight.
There will be no more audibly obscene speculations on any subject from anybody in this courtroom as long as I'm sitting here. Do you understand? Mr. Ewell nodded, but I don't think he did. Judge Taylor sighed and said, All right, Mr. Gilmer. Thank you, sir. Mr. Ewell, would you tell us, in your own words, what happened on the evening of November 21st, please? Jem grinned and pushed his hair back. Just in your own words was Mr. Gilmer's trademark. We often wondered who else's words Mr. Gilmer was afraid his witness might employ.
Well, the night of November 21, I was coming in from the woods with a load of kindling, and just as I got to the fence, I heard Mayella screaming like a stuck hog inside the house.
Here Judge Taylor glanced sharply at the witness and must have decided his speculations devoid of evil intent, for he subsided sleepily.
What time was it, Mr. Ewell?
Just before sundown. Well, I was saying, Mayella was screaming fit to beat Jesus.
Another glance from the bench silenced Mr. Ewell.
Yes, she was screaming, said Mr. Gilmer.
Mr. Ewell looked confusedly at the judge.
Well, Mayella was raising this holy racket, so I dropped my load and run as fast as I could, but I run into the fence. But when I got disentangled, I run up to the window, and I seen...
Mr. Ewell's face grew scarlet. He stood up and pointed his finger at Tom Robinson.
I seen that black nigger yonder rutting on my Mayella!
So serene was Judge Taylor's court that he had few occasions to use his gavel, but he hammered fully 5 minutes. Atticus was on his feet at the bench, saying something to him. Mr. Heck Tate, as first officer of the county, stood in the middle aisle, quelling the packed courtroom. Behind us, there was an angry, muffled groan from the colored people. Reverend Sykes leaned across Dill and me, pulling at Jem's elbow.
Mr. Jem, he said, you better take Miss Jean Louise home. Mr. Jem, you hear me?
Jem turned his head.
Scout, go home.
Dill, you and Scout, go home.
You gotta make me first,
I said, remembering Atticus's blessed dictum. Jem scowled furiously at me, then said to Reverend Sykes, I think it's okay, Reverend. She doesn't understand it. I was mortally offended.
I most certainly do. I can understand anything you can.
Aw, hush. She doesn't understand it, Reverend. She ain't 9 yet.
Reverend Sykes's black eyes were anxious.
Mr. Finch, know you all are here? This ain't fit for Miss Jean Louise, or you boys either.
Jem shook his head.
He can't see us this far away. It's all right, Reverend.
I knew Jem would win, because I knew nothing could make him leave now. Dill and I were safe for a while. Atticus could see us from where he was, if he looked. As Judge Taylor banged his gavel, Mr. Ewell was sitting smugly in the witness chair, surveying his handiwork. With one phrase, he had turned happy picnickers into a sulky, tense, murmuring crowd, being slowly hypnotized by gavel taps, lessening in intensity, until the only sound in the courtroom was a dim pink, pink, pink. The judge might have been rapping the bench with a pencil. In possession of his court once more, Judge Taylor leaned back in his chair. He looked suddenly weary. His age was showing, and I thought about what Atticus had said. He and Mrs. Taylor didn't kiss much. He must have been nearly 70.
There has been a request, Judge Taylor said, that this courtroom be cleared of spectators, or at least of women and children.
A request that will be denied for the time being. People generally see what they look for and hear what they listen for, and they have the right to subject their children to it. But I can assure you of one thing. You will receive what you see and hear in silence, or you will leave this courtroom. But you won't leave it until the whole boiling lot of you come before me on contempt charges. Mr. Yule, you will keep your testimony within the confines of Christian English usage, if that is possible. Proceed, Mr. Gilmer.
Mr. Yule reminded me of a deaf mute. I was sure he had never heard the words Judge Taylor directed at him. His mouth struggled silently with them, but their import registered on his face. Smugness faded from it, replaced by a dogged earnestness that fooled Judge Taylor not at all. As long as Mr. Yule was on the stand, the judge kept his eyes on him, as if daring him to make a false move. Mr. Gilmer and Atticus exchanged glances. Atticus was sitting down again, his fist rested on his cheek, and we could not see his face. Mr. Gilmer looked rather desperate. A question from Judge Taylor made him relax. Mr. Yule, did you see the defendant having sexual intercourse with your daughter?
Yes, I did.
The spectators were quiet, but the defendant said something. Atticus whispered to him, and Tom Robinson was silent.
"You say you were at the window?" asked Mr. Gilmer.
"Yes, sir."
"How far is it from the ground?"
"About 3 foot."
"Did you have a clear view of the room?"
"Yes, sir."
"How did the room look?"
"Well, it was all slung about, like there was a fight."
"What did you do when you saw the defendant?"
"Well, I run around the house to get in, but he run out the front door just ahead of me. I sawed who he was, all right. I was too distracted about Mayella to run after him. I run in the house, and she was lying on the floor, squalling."
"Then what did you do?"
"Why, I run for Tate, quick as I could. I knowed who it was, all right. Lived down yonder in that nigger nest, past the house every day."
"Judge, I've asked this county for 15 years to clean out that nest down yonder. They're dangerous to live around, sides devaluing my property."
"Thank you, Mr. Yule," said Mr. Gilmer hurriedly.
The witness made a hasty descent from the stand and ran smack into Atticus, who had risen to question him. Judge Taylor permitted the court to laugh.
"Just a minute, sir," said Atticus genially. "Could I ask you a question or two?"
Mr. Yule backed up into the witness chair, settled himself, and regarded Atticus with haughty suspicion. An expression common to Macon County witnesses when confronted by opposing counsel.
"Mr. Yule," Atticus began, "folks were doing a lot of running that night. Let's see. You say you ran to the house, you ran to the window, you ran inside, you ran to Mayella, you ran for Mr. Tate. Did you, during all this running, run for a doctor?"
"Wasn't no need to. I seen what happened."
"But there's one thing I don't understand," said Atticus. "Weren't you concerned with Mayella's condition?"
"I most positively was," said Mr. Yule. "I seen who done it."
"No, I mean her physical condition. Did you not think the nature of her injuries warranted immediate medical attention?"
"What?"
"Didn't you think she should have had a doctor immediately?"
The witness said he never thought of it. He had never called a doctor to any of his'n in his life.
and if he had, it would have cost him $5. "That all?" he asked.
"Not quite," said Atticus casually. "Mr. Yule, you heard the sheriff's testimony, didn't you?"
"How's that?"
"You were in the courtroom when Mr. Heck Tate was on the stand, weren't you? You heard everything he said, didn't you?" Mr. Yule considered the matter carefully and seemed to decide that the question was safe.
"Yes," he said.
"Do you agree with his description of Mayella's injuries?"
"How's that?"
Atticus looked around at Mr. Gilmer and smiled. Mr. Yule seemed determined not to give the defense the time of day. "Mr. Tate testified that her right eye was blackened, that she was beaten around the..."
"Oh, yeah," said the witness. "I hold with everything Tate said."
"You do?" asked Atticus mildly. "I just want to make sure." He went to the court reporter, said something, and the reporter entertained us for some minutes by reading Mr. Tate's testimony as if it were stock market quotations. "Which eye her left? Oh, yes, that'd make it her right. It was her right eye, Mr. Finch. I remember now she was bunged." He flipped the page. "Up on that side of the face. Sheriff, please repeat what you said. It was her right eye, I said." "Thank you, Bert," said Atticus. "You heard it again, Mr. Yule. Do you have anything to add to it? Do you agree with the sheriff?"
"I holds with Tate. Her eye was blacked, and she was mighty beat up."
The little man seemed to have forgotten his previous humiliation from the bench. It was becoming evident that he thought Atticus an easy match. He seemed to grow ruddy again. His chest swelled, and once more he was a red little rooster. I thought he'd burst his shirt at Atticus's next question. "Mr. Yule, can you read and write?" Mr. Gilmer interrupted.
"Objection," he said. "Can't see what witness's literacy has to do with the case. Irrelevant and immaterial."
Judge Taylor was about to speak, but Atticus said, "Judge, if you'll allow the question, plus another one, you'll soon see."
"All right, let's see," said Judge Taylor. "But make sure we see, Atticus. Overruled."
Mr. Gilmer seemed as curious as the rest of us as to what bearing the state of Mr. Yule's education had on the case.
"I'll repeat the question," said Atticus. "Can you read and write?" "I most positively can."
"Will you write your name and show us?"
"I most positively will. How do you think I signed my relief checks?"
Mr. Yule was endearing himself to his fellow citizens. The whispers and chuckles below us probably had to do with what a card he was. I was becoming nervous. Atticus seemed to know what he was doing, but it seemed to me that he had gone frog-sticking without a light. Never, 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 on cross-examination, ask a witness a question you don't already know the answer to, was a tenet I absorbed with my baby food. Do it, and you'll often get an answer you don't want, an answer that might wreck your case. Atticus was reaching into the inside pocket of his coat. He drew out an envelope, then reached into his vest pocket and unclipped his fountain pen. He moved leisurely and had turned so that he was in full view of the jury. He unscrewed the fountain pen cap and placed it gently on his table. He shook the pen a little, then handed it, with the envelope, to the witness.
"Would you write your name for us?" he asked. "Clearly now, so the jury can see you do it."
Mr. Yule wrote on the back of the envelope and looked up complacently to see Judge Taylor staring at him as if he were some fragrant gardenia in full bloom on the witness stand, to see Mr. Gilmer half sitting, half standing at his table. The jury was watching him. One man was leaning forward with his hands over the railing.
"What's so interesting?" he asked.
"You're left-handed, Mr. Yule," said Judge Taylor. Mr. Yule turned angrily to the judge and said he didn't see what his being left-handed had to do with it, that he was a Christ-fearing man and Atticus Finch was taking advantage of him. Tricking lawyers like Atticus Finch took advantage of him all the time with their tricking ways. He had told them what happened. He'd say it again and again, which he did. Nothing Atticus asked him after that shook his story, that he'd looked through the window, then ran the nigger off, then ran for the sheriff. Atticus finally dismissed him. Mr. Gilmer asked him one more question.
"About your writing with your left hand, are you ambidextrous, Mr. Yule?" "I most positively am not. I can use one hand good as the other. One hand good as the other," he added, glaring at the defense table.
Jim seemed to be having a quiet fit. He was pounding the balcony rail softly, and once he whispered, "We've got him." I didn't think so. Atticus was trying to show, it seemed to me, that Mr. Yule could have beaten up Mayella. That much I could follow. If her right eye was blacked, and she was beaten mostly on the right side of the face, it would tend to show that a left-handed person did it. Sherlock Holmes and Jem Finch would agree, but Tom Robinson could easily be left-handed, too. Like Mr. Heck Tate, I imagined a person facing me, went through a swift mental pantomime, and concluded that he might have held her with his right hand and pounded her with his left. I looked down at him. His back was to us, but I could see his broad shoulders and bull-thick neck. He could easily have done it. I thought Jem was counting his chickens. Chapter 18. But someone was booming again.
"Mayella Violet Yule!"
A young girl walked to the witness stand. As she raised her hand and swore that the evidence she gave would be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help her God, she seemed somehow fragile-looking. But when she sat facing us in the witness chair, she became what she was, a thick-bodied girl accustomed to strenuous labor. In Macomb County, it was easy to tell when someone bathed regularly, as opposed to yearly lavations. Mr. Yule had a scalded look, as if an overnight soaking had deprived him of protective layers of dirt. His skin appeared to be sensitive to the elements. Mayella looked as if she tried to keep clean, and I was reminded of the row of red geraniums in the Yule yard. Mr. Gilmer asked Mayella to tell the jury, in her own words, what happened on the evening of November 21st of last year. Just in her own words, please. Mayella sat silently. "Where were you at dusk on that evening?" began Mr. Gilmer patiently.
"On the porch."
"Which porch?"
"Ain't but one, the front porch."
"What were you doing on the porch?"
"Nothing."
Judge Taylor said, "Just tell us what happened. You can do that, can't you?" Mayella stared at him and burst into tears. She covered her mouth with her hands and sobbed. Judge Taylor let her cry for a while. Then he said,
"That's enough now. Don't be afraid of anybody here, as long as you tell the truth. All this is strange to you, I know, but you've nothing to be ashamed of and nothing to fear. What are you scared of?"
Mayella said something behind her hands.
"What was that?" asked the judge.
"Him,"
she sobbed, pointing at Atticus. "Mr. Finch?" She nodded vigorously, saying,
don't want him doing me like he done Papa, trying to make him out left-handed."
Judge Taylor scratched his thick white hair. It was plain that he had never been confronted with a problem of this kind.
"How old are you?"
he asked.
19 and a half, Mayella said.
Judge Taylor cleared his throat and tried unsuccessfully to speak in soothing tones.
"Mr. Finch has no idea of scaring you," he growled. "And if he did, I'm here to stop him. That's one thing I'm sitting up here for. Now, you're a big girl, so you just sit up straight and tell us what happened to you. You can do that, can't you?"
I whispered to Jem, "Has she got good sense?"
Jem was squinting down at the witness stand.
"Can't tell yet," he said. "She's got enough sense to get the judge sorry for her. But she might be just, oh, I don't know."
Mollified, Mayella gave Atticus a final, terrified glance and said to Mr. Gilmer,
"Well, sir, I was on the porch and he came along and, you see, there was this old shiffer robe in the yard Papa brought in to chop up for kindling. Papa told me to do it while he was off in the woods, but I wasn't feeling strong enough then. So he came by."
"Who is he?" Mayella pointed to Tom Robinson.
"I'll have to ask you to be more specific, please," said Mr. Gilmer. "The reporter can't put down gestures very well."
"That and yonder," she said. "Robinson."
"Then what happened?"
"I said, 'Come here, nigger, and bust up this shiffer robe for me. I got a nickel for you.' He could have done it easy enough, he could. So he come in the yard, and I went in the house to get him the nickel, and I turned around, and 'fore I knew it, he was on me. Just run up behind me, he did. He got me round the neck, cussing me and saying dirt. I fought and hollered, but he had me round the neck. He hit me again and again."
Mr. Gilmer waited for Mayella to collect herself. She had twisted her handkerchief into a sweaty rope. When she opened it to wipe her face, it was a mass of creases from her hot hands. She waited for Mr. Gilmer to ask another question. But when he didn't, she said,
"He chunked me on the floor and choked me and took advantage of me."
"Did you scream?" asked Mr. Gilmer. "Did you scream and fight back?"
"Reckon I did. Hollered for all I was worth. Kicked and hollered loud as I could."
"Then what happened?"
"I don't remember too good, but next thing I knew, Papa was in the room, a-standing over me, hollering, 'Who done it? Who done it?' Then I sort of fainted, and the next thing I knew, Mr. Tate was pulling me up off of the floor and leading me to the water bucket."
Apparently Mayella's recital had given her confidence, but it was not her father's brash kind. There was something stealthy about hers, like a steady-eyed cat with a twitchy tail.
"You say you fought him off as hard as you could. Fought him tooth and nail?" asked Mr. Gilmer.
"I positively did,"
Mayella echoed her father.
"You are positive that he took full advantage of you?"
Mayella's face contorted, and I was afraid that she would cry again. Instead, she said,
"He'd done what he was after."
Mr. Gilmer called attention to the hot day by wiping his head with his hand.
"That's all for the time being," he said pleasantly. "But you stay there. I expect big bad Mr. Finch has some questions to ask you." "State will not prejudice the witness against counsel for the defense," murmured Judge Taylor primly. "At least not at this time."
Atticus got up grinning, but instead of walking to the witness stand, he opened his coat and hooked his thumbs in his vest. Then he walked slowly across the room to the windows. He looked out, but didn't seem especially interested in what he saw. Then he turned and strolled back to the witness stand. From long years of experience, I could tell he was trying to come to a decision about something. "Miss Mayella," he said, smiling, "I won't try to scare you for a while, not yet. Let's just get acquainted. How old are you?"
"Said I was 19. Said it to the judge yonder."
Mayella jerked her head resentfully at the bench. "So you did. So you did, ma'am. You'll have to bear with me, Miss Mayella. I'm getting along and can't remember as well as I used to. I might ask you things you've already said before, but you'll give me an answer, won't you?" "Good." I could see nothing in Mayella's expression to justify Atticus's assumption that he had secured her wholehearted cooperation. She was looking at him furiously.
"Won't answer a word you say, long as you keep on mocking me," she said.
"Ma'am?" said Atticus, startled.
"Long as you keep on making fun of me."
Judge Taylor said, "Mr. Finch is not making fun of you. What's the matter with you?" Mayella looked from under lowered eyelids at Atticus, but she said to the judge,
"Long's he keeps on calling me ma'am and saying Miss Mayella, I don't have to take his sass. I ain't called upon to take it."
Atticus resumed his stroll to the windows and let Judge Taylor handle this one. Judge Taylor was not the kind of figure that ever evoked pity, but I did feel a pang for him as he tried to explain. "That's just Mr. Finch's way," he told Mayella. "We've done business in this court for years and years, and Mr. Finch is always courteous to everybody. He's not trying to mock you. He's trying to be polite. That's just his way." The judge leaned back. "Atticus, let's get on with these proceedings. And let the record show that the witness has not been sassed. Her views to the contrary."
I wondered if anybody had ever called her ma'am or Miss Mayella in her life. Probably not, as she took offense to routine courtesy. What on earth was her life like? I soon found out.
"You say you're 19, Atticus resumed. "How many sisters and brothers have you?" He walked from the windows back to the stand.
"7, she said, and I wondered if they were all like the specimen I had seen the first day I started to school.
"You the eldest? The oldest?"
"Yes."
"How long has your mother been dead?"
"Don't know. Long time."
"Did you ever go to school?"
"Read and write good as Papa yonder."
Mayella sounded like a Mr. Jingle in a book I had been reading. "How long did you go to school?"
2 year. 3 year. Dunno.
Slowly but surely I began to see the pattern of Atticus's questions. From questions that Mr. Gilmer did not deem sufficiently irrelevant or immaterial to object to, Atticus was quietly building up before the jury a picture of the Yule's home life. The jury learned the following things. Their relief check was far from enough to feed the family, and there was strong suspicion that Papa drank it up anyway. He sometimes went off in the swamp for days and came home sick. The weather was seldom cold enough to require shoes, but when it was, you could make dandy ones from strips of old tires. The family hauled its water in buckets from a spring that ran out at one end of the dump. They kept the surrounding area clear of trash, and it was everybody for himself as far as keeping clean went. If you wanted to wash, you hauled your own water.
The younger children had perpetual colds and suffered from chronic ground itch. There was a lady who came around sometimes and asked Mayella why she didn't stay in school. She wrote down the answer.